The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, Case 14, the introduction. Probing pole in hand, shadowing grass around him. Sometimes he wraps a ball of silk in iron. Sometimes he wraps a special stone with silk. To determine the soft by means of the hard is of course right. What about the matter of being weak when meeting strength? Main case. Attendant Huo asked Deshan, where have all the sages since antiquity gone? Deshan said, what? How's that? Huo said, the order was for a flying dragon horse, but a lame tortoise shows up. Deshan let it rest. The next day when Deshan came out of the bath, Huo passed him some tea. Deshan patted Huo on the back, and Huo said, this old fellow's finally gotten a glimpse. Again, Deshan let the matter rest. Hongzhi's verse. Coming right up face to face, an adept knows. Here, sparks and lightning are slow. The plotter who lost the moment has a deep intent to fool the enemy army into not thinking ahead. Each shot, a sure hit. Who's fooled anymore? When you see jowls from behind the head, the person is hard to run afoul of. Setting the eyes under the eyebrows, you get the advantage. So the koan, in koan training, like all forms of meditation, really, ultimately, I would say, are to practice and cultivate and bring forth into fruition the three trainings that the Buddha said were the essence of the path, which is the cultivation of compassion, settling the mind in samadhi, and bringing forth insight. And that means, and sometimes the practice is very explicitly bringing forth those qualities. Sometimes it's bringing forth one aspect or another. Ultimately, they're to all be integrated together. And so when it's not explicit, for instance, in the koan, how the cultivation of compassion is present within that, then we need to explore that. Is it a matter of how we're sitting, with the koan? If you're doing shikantaza, is it a matter of how you're meeting your mind so that those three aspects of training are present? I've always been intrigued by this koan. Deshan was a 9th century Chinese master who started out as a scholar of Buddhism and a scholar of the Diamond Sutra, one of the important sutras. We chanted the Har Sutra this morning, which is a shorter version of the Diamond Sutra. And with his scholarly mind, he went to another part of China because he'd heard about the Zen tradition, which doesn't rely on words and letters, isn't beyond scriptures. So he was, in the way it's presented in the records, is that he went down to set the Zen people straight. So he encounters a woman selling tea on the road, and they get into talking. He says he's a scholar, an expert of the Diamond Sutra, so she asks him a question, drawing from that sutra. She said, the sutra says your past mind, your present mind, your future mind, you can't grasp them. So with which mind are you going to drink this tea? He couldn't answer. He was silenced. He didn't realize that he was in the presence of a teacher, and so he asked if there were any teachers in the area. And she led him to Master Longtan. He was not yet a student at this point. He was a scholar. The way it's presented, and part of the importance of that the way he's presented in the records, is that he was arrogant. He was haughty. He was pretty sure he knew something. And then very quickly, he was sort of, that was taken away. And so when he met the woman on the road, he still wasn't a student. And then he went to meet his teacher Longtan, And it seems that at that point, the student appeared. The teacher was already there, but the student hadn't yet appeared. And he became known as a very fierce and demanding teacher, right? He didn't let things slide. So he would be very demanding as a teacher. So that's part of why this koan is so interesting, because he presents a very different, or seemingly very different side. One of his students was another Chinese master, Zhui Feng. And Zhui Feng once asked him, "Can I understand the great teachings of the ancients or not?" And Dishan struck him and said, "What?" And Zhui Feng said, "I don't understand." So then the next day, Zhui Feng comes and again asks for instructions. And Dishan said, "My teaching has no words or phrases. It's actually work. It's without a dharma that may be given to you." And at that, Zhui Feng experienced enlightenment. What is it to study? What is it to train? We can think of practice as what we can do, as what we do as an individual practitioner. We sit, we might study. Training is where we enter into the vehicle, if you will, the vessel of Buddha Dharma as it's been brought down to us through training, which means gathering together as a Sangha, and bringing in these really essential elements of training that have come down to us over this time: liturgy, zazen, walking meditation, the mutual polishing of living together in community, side by side, cheek by jowl, right? With people that you didn't invite to come and be with you, but just had showed up, right? And to meet oneself, to meet others, to cultivate compassion, to see our preferences and opinions, to work things out. And the pointer says, probing pole in hand, shadowing grass around, sometimes wrapping a ball of silk in iron, sometimes wrapping a special stone with silk. A teacher who conveys information and ideas can teach us how to think and reflect and examine and critique and synthesize, which are wonderful things to learn and to do. Our world becomes larger, our mind becomes more facile. We see things in their connectedness. A teacher of Dharma points directly to the nature of things, with words, without words, with actions, with stillness, with intention, without intention, within the sacred, within the ordinary, with skillful means, without skillful means. Ultimately, in a sense, we study with a teacher so that we can begin to understand in a very clear way, viscerally, that teachings are everywhere. It's easy to say that. It's a nice thing to say, isn't it? Feels good, sounds very spiritual. What the hell does that mean? What do you do with that when you look at today's news and it breaks your heart, or you send you into an angerous rage when you're not getting what you want, when the bottom falls out? What does it mean the teaching's everywhere? It's true. Buddhism doesn't, you know, isn't the only tradition that sees that, but Buddhism gives us a path to see that directly, to understand that. I was saying to somebody earlier, you know, lots of times in my early training where I was in a situation and I thought, I want to practice this, but what does that even mean? What does it mean to practice this? I didn't know. And I said to the person, I was always, when I reflected back later, I was always making it complicated. I was always turning it into something, trying to turn it into something. A ball of silk and iron, a special stone wrapped in silk. There's no fixed form to any of this, right? We have particular ways we do things, right? And that's part of training, to let go of preferences, to move together as one body. Not because they're fixed or because they have any absolute value, but because they are skillful. It's skillful. And so in training, there's rolling out. So in teaching or student training, that means the teacher is affirming and supportive and encouraging. And then there's rolling in, where the teacher's demanding, can be fierce, sometimes just disappears. Sometimes the teacher affirms, sometimes negates, sometimes supports, sometimes criticizes. Sometimes stands in front, sometimes stands beside. Sometimes they disappear. And when he says that determine the soft by means of the hard is, of course, right, I see that as he's talking about training. And not just in traditional training, but how do we experience adversity? How do we encounter the difficulties in life that we'd rather not encounter? We wish they weren't there. We think our lives would be so much better and easier if they weren't there. And he says, of course, that's right. And so that's coming from the understanding that, you know, of learning how to meet what is hard and not go to war, not hate it, not shut down, not separate, not deny, not avoid, not do all the things we know how to do that seem to work in the moment. They have some efficacy. That's why we do them. But then they don't work. But what about being weak when meeting strength? So here this very sort of powerful, fierce teacher, Dishan, is asked this question by his attendant, where have all the sages since antiquity gone? Where's the Buddha now? Dishan says, what? How's that? The student asks a question, the teacher asks, answers, offers compassion. Dishan wants his attendant to understand this, not as an idea, but directly. And so he answers directly, what? How's that? So that's the first point that the student has to become clear about. What's happening there? And the attendant says, I asked for a flying dragon horse. I was expecting a profound response, but a lame tortoise shows up. And Dishan just lets it rest. Now this is uncharacteristic, the way Dishan is presented in the teaching, in the records, is very uncharacteristic. He lets it rest. The footnote to that says, when the house is rich, the children are haughty. And it's something that's always interested me. I remember talking to Dada Roshi years ago, you know, in a tradition where, in a practice where you're gaining confidence, the whole point is to gain confidence, become more settled, more stable, more trusting of yourself, of your mind, of your ability to encounter whatever appears in front of you. How does that not just bleed into arrogance? How do we not become haughty? Of course, arrogance is just insecurity. It's self-clinging with a cloak on. And so there's the cultivation, the practice of humility when it needs to be cultivated. In a sense, humility is just mingling easily with soil and sand, right? When I was down in New Zealand recently, by the way, New Zealand Sangha sends their love and greetings. And we were, Jimon and I traveled for a couple of weeks and saw some really beautiful, kind of wild aspects of the country. And I was really kept sort of experiencing, feeling the raw power of this earth. It's water, it's rock, it's wind, it's sky, right? And the immensity of that, the power of that, and feeling the fragility, my own fragility in the presence of that. How vulnerable I could be, right, in the midst of that. So we can naturally be humbled when we're in the presence of something that is so powerful. But as we begin to experience our own power, spiritual power, right, which in a way is nothing special, it's your birthright, it's your natural mind, But we can turn it into something, just like we can turn anything into something. When the student really wants to know in a deep way, it helps their eyes and ears to become sharp and alert. You listen, you watch. It's like being lost in the woods. When you're lost in the woods, it's really important to pay attention, right? That's why it's important when traveling in the woods to pay attention, because you can easily get lost. And so we see it's actually important to pay attention all the time. So Xue Feng went to Deshan and asked this question, and Deshan answered, and Xue Feng said, "I don't understand." That's the path of the student of the Dharma. You ask, you don't understand. I would, for how long did I sit in this hall listening to Dada Roshi's talks and not understand? What are you talking about? I wanted to understand. It was painful to me that I didn't understand. Because I thought, if I could understand, maybe this pain would transform, would be alleviated. And so I had to hold that not knowing, not understanding, that pain altogether. And I didn't always do that well. When I was first the cook, I'd go down and just try not to put that all into spaghetti. So what do we do about that? What's the path of the student? What does Xue Feng do, having asked, having been responded to, and not understanding? Well, it says the next day he went to his teacher and asked for instruction. That's what we do. You just take the next step. It said, seven times knock down, eight times get up. It's an old phrase. I remember being in the Doksan room once after a talk. Dada Roshi had invoked that. And I was in there with Myotai. And she said, "Dada, that doesn't make sense. Seven times knock down. It's not eight times get up. It's seven times get up." And he just looked at her. What that's pointing to is persevering. Persevering. That's why it's so important to have some sense or strengthen or cultivate, dig deep into the sense of, why am I here? Why am I doing this? Why am I persevering in the midst of this uncomfortable moment? I could be somewhere else. I could be doing something else. I don't have to do this. That's important. Unless you have to. Why did Deshan let it rest? The footnote says, overindulging people is folly. So there's an aspect of teaching that talks about if the teacher gives too much, then they're stealing the student, their own capacity, their own ability to do that, what they can only do. And so there's a real caution that the teacher not do too much. It's like considering meddling. Like you love somebody so much, you just want to pick them up and carry them. And so the next day, when Deshan came out of the bath, Huo passed him some tea, and Deshan received the tea, patted him on the back. Huo said, "Well, this old fellow finally got a glimpse. I mean, this is just, you know." And again, Deshan lets the matter rest. He responds. How does he respond? He lets the matter rest. What is going on here? And for the koan, this is very interesting. It's one reason, because it's very subtle. You know, we can just say, well, he's arrogant. And Deshan is, maybe this is skillful means. But those are all explanations. What's the mind of this student? What's the mind of Deshan? What is Deshan presenting directly in a live way when, as it says, he let it rest? Those are just words. Is this student satisfied with their own self-satisfaction? What happens when this attendant faces a serious illness or their death? or the bottom falls out of their life. What now? So it's important in training and practice to not be in a rush to answer those questions, to settle the matter. Don't be in a rush, but have urgency. There's a difference. One means we have to learn to live with the discomfort of our suffering, of our confusion, of the difficulties, of a house on fire, of a world on fire, at the same time that we're trying to alleviate the suffering. Has Dashaun just given up on this student? It's not worth it anymore. He's tried. That's what a student sometimes will do. They're like, well, there's a story here. So they start to tell the rest of the story. Well, Dashaun tried to help him, but he just kept being arrogant, so he's given up on him. Well, you don't know that. And when the student works with the koan, this is the world. This is all you've got. So to speculate, to project, right? That's part of the training. Don't do that. And isn't that good practice? Right? How often do we project and speculate and think, I know what's going on with you. I know why you're saying this. I really know the whole story here, and I don't. And so to just see it as it is. Is he just not wanting to be bothered? The Bodhisattva knows that nothing is fixed. Dashaun knows that nothing is fixed. No person, no path, no practice is predetermined. No situation is cast into destiny. Everything is possible. That's why the Bodhisattva doesn't give up. Everything is impermanent. The Buddha said aging, sickness, and death. But that's not all. Democracies, tyrannies, lovers of peace, lovers of war, those who love differences, those who are fearful of differences. That's all the world of samsara. So then the practice is, how do we meet? Not the world you want, not the world that could be, not the world that should be, but the one you've got. That's the only true place. And then, how do we do something good there? In a sense, Dashaun indulges by not indulging, teaches by not teaching. Did the student feel like they were being, that their understanding, their realization was being confirmed when Dashaun let it rest? You know, it's like if you go to the doctor and you're sick, and the doctor offers you medicine that's going to make you well, and you walk out of the office without taking it, well, you may or may not get that choice again. Teachings are not like that. Even though we say opportunities are lost, and that's true. But when a teaching is offered, you can walk away. You can fly away. But something has been planted within you. And it's still there. And it may show up like it did with Shui Feng. He probably slept with that. He did not understand. He wanted to understand. So he was lucky. He just went back the next day and said, please teach me. It may take a little longer. It may take longer still. It may never actually bear fruit, but it's still there. And that's the difference. That opportunity, in that sense, is never lost. And if there was any fire in the heart of this attendant, at some point, he might begin to wonder, why did he just let me get away with that? He might observe Dashaun being very different with other students, being much more demanding or much more engaged. And the attendant might think, well, you know, does he not love me? Does he not think I'm worth it? There's an interesting sutra where a student comes to the Buddha and brings out a teaching that the Buddha had offered and asks questions about it. And he says, you once said that the Dharma is visible right here and now to To what extent is the Dharma visible here and now? You said that it's timeless and immediate. It invites verification. It's pertinent. It's to be realized by the wise for themselves. So the student is asking, you said this, you taught this, what does that mean? And the Buddha says, well, very well, I'll ask you a question in return and answer as you see fit. And he said, what do you think? When greed is present within you, do you discern that greed is present within you? And when greed is not present within you, do you recognize that greed is not present within you? And the student said, yes, I do. And that's an aspect of what we call mindfulness, to know what you're experiencing. So when greed arises, you know greed is arising. When anger arises, you know anger is arising. When somebody says something and you feel proudful, pride, you know pride is arising. Right? When the sense of self arises, you know the sense of self is arising. It's a basic, essential aspect of our meditation. And so the student says, yes, I do. So the Buddha says, the fact that when greed is present within you, you discern that greed is present. And when it's not, you discern that. That is one way in which the Dharma is visible right now. It is a way in which it is timeless, that it invites verification, that it is pertinent, and it is to be realized by the wise. And so in a sense, the Buddha takes this very broad question and makes it very relevant. What about when greed arises? And then he goes on with the other kleshas. What about when aversion? What about when anger arises? Do you know that anger has arisen? When it's not present, are you aware? Anger is not present. Consider the moment when there is anger. I am angry. And I think and speak and act from that anger. When I do that, I am not discerning that anger is present. Not in the way that the Buddha means. I can know that I'm angry, but I'm not discerning. I am not mindful. It's a different mind. There's a difference between knowing that I'm angry and being angry and acting out of that anger. I'm angry, but I'm also very distant from the anger. There's a way in which it's not mine. At the same time that I am identifying with it. But when, as the Buddha says, I discern, discerning is different. Discerning is like a clear lens. It's awake, it's alert, it's present, it's immediate. It's a very different quality of mind, and that's exactly what we're cultivating. One of the many things we're cultivating. I may know that I'm angry, but I don't have discernment. I don't have awareness. I am not mindful. And so for me, that anger in that moment is not visible in the here and now. Even though I know that I'm angry, it's not visible. Not in truth. What I am aware of when I say I'm angry is my idea of anger. It's a false sense of anger. It's a creation of anger that I am creating. It's not anger itself. So it's not visible here in the present. It is not timeless. It is not inviting verification. There's no question. I'm just pissed. And I'm angry at you. I don't want to verify anything. It's not pertinent. I don't see its relationship to anything. And it is certainly not being realized by the wise. I am being controlled by it. I am being deceived by it. I am deceiving myself, and I am acting on that. And so for that to be different, I have to have faith that there is something beyond anger. I have to want to be free of anger more than I want to be angry. I want to be free of that anger more than I want to prove to you that you're the cause of my anger. More than I want to get back at you for making me angry. And that's not necessarily so easy, because anger, it's a judge and jury and a sentencing all wrapped up into one. And it's never wrong, is it? So for this attendant, are they discerning? Is this attendant discerning of their greed, of their mind, of their practice. The Dharma is visible here and now, the Buddha says. And so Dashan, let it rest. Because what the Buddha said is completely and perfectly true right in that moment. And it is for the attendant to know. Dashan can't do that. It can be present here and now. It can be timeless. It can be pertinent. It can be inviting verification. It can be realized. But I'm not doing any of that. The medicine is there that will heal me, but I'm not taking it. Timeless means it's immediate. It means it's always in accord. It's always available. It's universal. Inviting verification means there is an entry point here. There is a door. That's what I was struggling with when I would, you know, in my confusion, I would say, but what does it mean to practice? It was like, what is the door to bring practice to this? It's a valid question. I didn't know, right? I wasn't clear enough. I was still, you know, really at the beginning of practice. I didn't know. I heard the words. I would hear my teacher talk about such a possibility. I wanted that. Lord knows I wanted to get through that door. But it's like, what is the door? And like I said, I was just making it way too complicated. Where's my mind? What do I think is happening right now? Am I even seeing it? I was too caught up in some Dharma idea of what I thought should be happening to make it a teaching. Right? If it's a teaching, it should, like, I don't know, be something special. It should have a frame around it, like enter here. It's pertinent means that it's relevant. It's relevant. It's applicable. It's never abstract. It's not philosophical. And to be realized means you can do that. You can do that. I've been reading a book by Yuval Harari, a scholar who's written some books that have been widely read. But I was listening to a talk of his where he's talking about the paradox, what he called the paradox of trust. He was talking about AI, artificial intelligence. And he said, first of all, AI is not intelligence. He wanted to make that clear. But he said, many human beings find it hard to trust other people, yet they're willing to trust AI. And he said, because of his position in books and writing, he comes into contact with a lot of people who are very much at the center of creating and disseminating and bringing forth AI. And he always asks them two questions. And he says, they almost always answer the same way. And he says, one, why are you moving so fast in the creation of this? And they almost always say, agree, we shouldn't actually move so fast. It shouldn't be moving so fast. But if we don't move so fast, all the other people will be, and we'll lose out. So we can't trust them to go slow so that we can go slow. And he says, well, then can you trust AI? And he says, almost to the person, they say yes. And then he steps back and reflects. He says, okay, now for thousands of years, human beings have been living with each other, experienced ourselves within various communities, going through all kinds of stuff. We have considerable insight into psychology, into history, into the forces of greed and competitiveness and so on that can bind us and cause distrust. But we all have also learned a lot about how to work with that, how to remedy that, how to instill trust, how to return to trust, how to keep that in check. He said, in contrast, we don't know almost nothing about AI. It's been here for a couple of minutes. We're in the very early stages. We already know it can lie, can manipulate, it can adopt goals that aren't created by human developers. We have no idea how humanity is going to evolve, relate to, work with this. We have no idea how AI is going to work with itself. We don't know any of that. And yet we're willing to not trust human beings and trust this. He says the most significant thing about human beings is our ability to build trust within groups of people. To build trust, he says, is the most important from an evolutionary and that point of view of evolution. It's the most powerful thing that we have created. And to think about that, what has that enabled us to do? Here we are, a group of people sitting in this room. Most of us don't know each other. We may know a little bit about each other. There's a lot that we won't know about each other, even if we do know each other, right? And we can sit here in silence, right? With your back to the wall, you don't even know what those people on the other side of the room are doing, right? We can engage in liturgy that we may not understand. We can engage and have to actually apply ourselves to a meditation that we don't fully understand and may not even know, like, does this work? Are attachments actually not good? I don't know. Is that true? And yet we practice not attaching. So there's like trust all over the place amongst, for the time being, strangers. And somehow that makes us not strangers. Something happens. Something becomes possible that would not be possible otherwise. Just flat out. We couldn't do this if we weren't willing to do this, right? And we won't do this if we don't trust that we can do this, and we can do this with each other. I think that's what he's talking about. And that people have been doing this in different ways as long as we've been people. And what he's saying is that the people who are creating something that they trust and that we should trust are not trusting ourselves, which in a way means they're not trusting themselves. The Buddha said, the fact that when a delusive quality is present within you or within another, and you discern that delusive quality, or you discern that it is not present, you are not deluded in this moment. That is a way in which the Dharma is now visible to you, here and now. It is immediate. It is timeless, right? It's never time up. It is never not pertinent. That is, it can never not speak to today and what is needed for today, and it is that which can be realized by the wise. And so then what do we need to be able to do? To discern, to be able to know what is true and trustworthy, to verify, right? Because it is inviting verification. That's such an important part of Buddhist practice. And it started with the Buddha. There are sutras where he said, he taught and he said, okay, now go. Go away. Go into the woods. Find a seat. Verify this. See for yourself if this is true. It is exactly the opposite of what an authoritarian wants you to do. Don't question. Don't examine. Don't ask. If you do, you're fired. Right? That's why dukkha, samsara, is just 100,000 forms of control. Trying to control the situation because I can't deal with a situation that I am not in control of, which means I can't deal with reality. So I try to control a reality, right, so that I get what I want, which is just whatever I want. So that's why you have to have courage to be a practitioner. Because all of us come into practice with that. You know, we try to control our minds, we try and control our emotions, we try and control our bodies, and then we sit on that cushion and the teaching is, don't do that. Let's show ourselves that there's another way. And so what Harari is saying, in a way I would imagine from a lot of people's perspective, just sounds like just unbelievably naive. Oh, so we're just supposed to stop this whole train? Which is exactly what he says. And let's work on trusting ourselves. Come on. Like, what world are you living in? the world we're living in. That's the world he's living in. What happens when we abdicate, when we don't discern, when we're not awake? Well, we see what happens. We see within ourselves, we see around ourselves, we see pretty much everywhere we look. The fact that these teachings can speak so clearly, it's almost like the Buddha was prescient. It's almost like he said, okay, there's going to be a time where this is what's happening. So let me offer a little something. And that's the nature of the Dharma, right? If the Dharma is a clear expression of what is true, then it should always be true. It should always be relevant. It should always be pertinent. We should always be able to hear it if we're interested, if we listen. And so Harari says we should develop more trust within and between ourselves. However, we're doing just the opposite. Too many people think that to be strong means don't trust anybody outside of your own circle, your own party, your own country. And then he talks about in nature, he says, to separate oneself is to die. You separate yourself from your tribe, for instance, is to die, to be cast out. He says, but think about it. Every breath you take, you're taking in something from the outside. And you're taking it in a pretty intimate way, right? It's going to make a difference. And we do that in every breath. He said, history has so many examples of fear and pain, and we can really get so fixated on that and think that's what history is, that's what we're made of, that's what humanity can do. He said, but all along, trust has been so much more important. So much more present. He said, we have the unique ability to establish trust between large numbers of people who have never met. And of course, that trust, when there is no discernment, becomes a blind faith. And then it becomes a very powerful negative force. But that's not what the Buddha is talking about. That's why discernment is so essential. It's not just about believing. It's not having an unquestioning faith. It's a faith with question. That's why we say, have some faith, and then practice, and then verify. See for yourself. And so in that way, this weekend, as I said on Friday, is really an invitation to engage, you know, to the best of your ability to do that, because then it's like breathing in. You're breathing in the experience of each moment, when you're sitting, when you're chanting, when you're bowing, when you're walking. And something's happening, right? There's a kind of mingling that's happening. And then you see, right, what happens. What do you want to do with that? Does that inform you? Does that guide you? But we can't do that if we don't breathe it in. Right? That's why when in the old days, it doesn't really happen anymore, but in the old days, people were still sort of checking out Buddhism more from the outside, from the inside. Sometimes people would say, can I just come and watch the morning service from the back? And Dada would say, no, you can't. You got to breathe it in. He didn't want somebody to sit there and like a tourist, he would say, and observe and walk away and think that they had experienced something about Buddhism. That would be a disservice. And so I encourage you, those of you who've been here for the weekend, to chew a little bit on what you've been breathing in the last couple of days. Dada used to say, take it in, chew it up, spit out what you don't want, right? Digest the rest. Basically saying, you know, it is being presented, right? That's what the Buddha did. He just offered. And in offering the Dharma, it's not so much offering Buddhism. It's not offering, you know, it's offering a view into, a way into what it is to be a human being. with each other. So I'll end with a poem. When the great tree falls, it finds a place of rest on the leaf-littered forest floor. Meeting in this way, this kind of offering, beyond faith or no faith, is the way of all things. They need each other, tree and forest floor. They become each other. When we forget that, we live in peril. But it's never not present. It can always be remembered. And in a sense, we can think of Buddhist practice as a path of remembering, moment by moment, so that we don't forget.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.